nobody was like disconnected, but there were a lot of people that were concerned about a lot of details. So this is really good because, I mean, it's really bad, right? If it was bad as a teacher, I taught you and you didn't learn it all. But it's really good because it doesn't matter if I teach you. It matters if you learn it. And this is where you start taking control of your own learning. So my job is to pick the topics we're going to cover and to structure the way in which we're going to go about them. And your job is to learn the material, right? But you have another job, and that's to decide how you want to learn the material. There are three ways in which you can learn the material. One is you can come to class well prepared, and then if we get to something that you don't understand, you can stop me, make sure you understand it, and then we go on. That might slow us down a little bit, but that's fine. That's really fine with me. If we don't cover everything I can imagine by the end of the semester, that's okay. We won't already. The syllabus doesn't have everything in it that I know. Right. So if we cover a little bit less, it's in the right order. So you can slow me down. Another perfectly fine thing that you can do is you can say, okay, I just got the reader's guide. I don't know all the details, but now I know the question and the structure and how to do it. So you can then say, okay, I'll sit here quietly, I'll soak it all up, I'll see the story, and I'll go home, and I'll go to Wikipedia, and I'll say, what the hell is compression? Right? Because I didn't understand that compression thing at all. But Wikipedia will tell you what compression is. What you had to get here was that that's the question. You didn't know that before you came here. Right? Okay. So that's a second way. Now, unfortunately, those two ways won't work for everybody because there are going to be some people who would like it the first way, except that by the time they know they have a question, we're like halfway through the rest of the class. And then they're like, I think I missed something way back there, and they're not going to feel like saying, wait a minute, would you start over, please? So it's also okay if, as you're preparing, if you see something you don't understand, send me a note and say, hey, look, I'm working really hard at getting the details right, but I'm just clueless on this. And I might send you back a note that says, well, that's okay, because that's not really very important, right, if it's what you're doing preparing to read. Or I might say, that's a really big point. I've done this with several people so far, and I generally reply to the entire mail address when I do this, because everybody's going to have the same kinds of questions about sorting stuff out. So I'm happy to reply just to you if you put in your email, please don't reply to everybody, but I would ask that you put that at the top of the email, just in case I read the email and fire off a reply and then later go back and get all the details right now. Ooh, so. But in general, if you're happy to have it shared, send me questions, and I'll send you answers. And they can be questions about what's coming up next week, like how to prepare, or they can be questions about what we covered this week. Right? Or things you'd like covered at the beginning of class next week, because you prepared, then you saw it in class, then you went home and thought about it some more, and it still doesn't make sense. So get those added to the beginning of class. And we'll use time like this at the beginning of class for each of these. Okay, so it's your class.
Am I right there? A lot of the materials being sort of front-loaded and not going to be working on projects.
So the structure of the class is, and I generally structure classes like this when there's a project, is that the class is designed to take you through all the things you need to know no matter what project you're going to do. And then, while you're doing your specialized projects, we're doing all these other specialized excursions. So yes, in a sense that's true. It's also true that the class is front-loaded in a way that, so for example, cross-linking retrieval comes later while you're working on your project. We're having fun with cross-linking retrieval. But it's also true that the class is front-loaded in another way. That the very first class, you probably came and you sat here and you said, hey, I think I understood that. And then you come to the very second class and you say, hey, I don't think I understood that. Right? So that's good, because if you didn't understand in the first class, you might not have come back. But you're stuck now. And so now the pressure ratchets up a little bit. And now you get good at following this increasing slope of the curve. And what happens with every one of my classes when I get teaching evaluations is at the end of the semester, the event, and you can think about this at the end of the semester, see if you think it's true. The end of the semester, people say, I got so good at climbing, and then the whole thing just flattened out, right? Like, what happened in the whole second half of the class? Right? And what really happened was, you got so good at climbing the steep slope, right? So, when you first encounter the slope, it looks like it's pretty damn steep. That's okay. Slow me down. Level it out. If you level it out too much, it won't be a very interesting class, right? I mean, you'll, at the end, you'll know the stuff you know at the beginning. If you let it be too steep, then it won't be a very interesting class either. It'll just, time will go by and eventually it'll end. So hold it to what you want it to be. And look, if one of you is pulling in one direction and the other of you are pulling in the other direction, I know how to handle that, right? We're not going to land up with one person pulling us all off in some direction. So feel free to jump in and try to start pulling, and we'll see where people pull. Good? Okay. It's a real danger in this format if you start thinking of it as a lecture class, like I'm going to talk and you're going to listen, right? I'm the guide. You guys are on the expedition. Who's in charge here? Well, the guide did not pay for the expedition. You did. All right, so use me as a guide. Okay. So there were several things that people found confusing. Some of them that I'm not going to talk about right now, but a few people found confusing, and you might recognize yourself in this. Was how do you actually build this? How do you do it, right? I understand, like, the theory, but I want to build this thing. Like, okay, patience. There'll be a project here. You get to build something. But in the meantime, the class is not about how to build. The class is about how it's built, what it's doing, not how to do it. So if you want to know how to build it, that's great. We can get there. But you'll get there sort of on your own, right? The idea of the class is to show you how it's built so that you can think of it as a large system. Say, okay, I have a system and I understand how this component works. I've looked inside the box, I understand how it works. We'll do that with each of the components. And then if you want to go build one, well, that's great. Take the component and go build it. Okay. Another one was log n. Like, what's this log n thing anyway? Okay. So, I'm a graphical kind of person, so even if I see all these equations, what I like to do is I like to draw a graph and say, okay, fine. If I've got n and I've got log n, and let's say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, okay? And then goes up, log n goes up more slowly. Now look, it goes up more slowly at some particular rate, and in the old days you needed tables of logarithms, and then you needed an electronic calculator, and you know, now you need Excel or something, right? You can actually plot this. Get Excel out and plot n and log n and plot them in. And you can see it goes up like that. If I draw another one of these, n squared, it goes up like that. Well, it doesn't go like that. You get that. It goes up like that for what? And you can plot that. Okay, now if I tell you this is how much you get and this is what you pay, all right, that's what this is. This is what you get, that's what you pay for. Then there's going to be some end beyond which you can't afford it. Right? Your computer's not fast enough, your computer's not big enough, your wallet's not big enough, whatever it is, you can't do that beyond some end. And that end comes at some point. Right? It's kind of like a brick wall. And if your budget doubles, you don't get very much more in, right? Now here, if your budget doubles, if you can afford this and your budget doubles, you can afford it. Okay? So this log n is way better than that n squared. And there's a n in between, that's a great one. Right? And there's an n cubed, and there's a log squared n, and you know, so there are a whole variety of these. But the ones you run into are log n, n, which is the straight line, and n squared. You run into those a lot. The answer is, you can't afford that. At some point, you just can't afford it. And here, if you can afford anything, you can afford everything. Got it? Search works like this. The lookup in search works like this, not like that. And the Microsoft Search My Hard Drive is that. I get a bigger hard drive, it takes more time. Right? Twice as big, twice as much time. So there, if your budget doubles, you get more. But you don't get everything. You just get more. Make sense? Okay. So that's why.
Somebody said, what's all this about Chinese? Right?
And not about, you know, why we're talking about Chinese in here, but what was it about Chinese that was interesting? Right? You know, why didn't you pick, like, Spanish or something? Right? What's the big deal in Chinese? So, Chinese has a couple of issues. One is, the characters don't fit into one byte. So you get all this character handling stuff. The other thing about Chinese is that people write Chinese the way people speak. They don't put breaks between the words. And so you get the what's a word question shows up. And those questions are bold, fundamental. They're not questions about Chinese. They're not like, you know, all these, you know, other languages and then Chinese are here. Weird. All languages are like Chinese. Right? So we have compound words in English. We have words we borrow from other languages that happen to be compounds in those languages. Volkswagen, right? Car for the people. So the same issues that you see coming up in Chinese are just more extreme versions of what exists in every language. So Chinese is a good way to illustrate what's going on. That wasn't actually the question people asked. People asked specific questions about Chinese. Like, I didn't understand why you would only take two characters and just index it. It's like, well, if you take every pair of characters, then the ones that show up in queries will be the ones that you have indexed. And a lot of other things you will have indexed that don't show up in queries, but that'll be okay. So thinking through that issue in the context of Chinese is helpful because the same trick works in English. Okay, but here's the big one. Here's the thing that a quarter of the class said, huh? And that was about compression. Right? And somebody actually stopped me and said, wait a minute, I don't see it. And so I said, okay, fine. First this, then this, then this. And then they said, okay, I got it, thanks. And the rest of you let it go. Instead of saying, wait a minute, I still don't see it. Okay. And it may be that it seemed to you like I just had to say everything that night, and if you slowed me down, we weren't going to get through it all. It's a reasonable concern, but slow me down, and we just won't get through it all. And it'll be okay. I'll deal with it. So let's reinvent compression. So let's say that I tell you that I'm going to show you a character, right? And the character is either going to be A or B. I'll tell you that right now. I'm going to show you a character, it's either going to be A or B. And I want you to tell, say I want all of you, people on this side of the room, to tell all of them, the people on the other side of the room, which character it is. Okay? But you can't say A or B. All you can do is send them bits. You can send them the character code for A. Remember what that is? Yeah. Or the character code for B. 56. Right? And I'm going to charge you per bit. And the way I'm going to charge you is that you have to send it to them either through this row or through that row. And they're going to charge you $1 per person per bit. You'd be better off to send it through this one. You probably figured that out already, right? So the question is, what's the smallest number of bits you need to tell them whether the character is an A or a B? And I'll give you one extra thing you can do. you can tell them in advance anything you want before you know what the character will be. Okay? So you ready to start? What do you want to tell them? I haven't shown you a character yet. So you can tell them anything you want now. You don't have to pay these people.
Zero's an A, one's a B.
Zero's an A, one's a B, that's what you want to tell them? Would that be okay with all you guys? Okay, great. So,
don't let him hear this.
Can't say that. You have to send them this.
That's the next character.
No, you have to send them this.
Zero's an A, so zero for
them. Okay, these guys will all collect their dollar. And what are you guys going to guess when you hear zero?
A.
Got it? What'd you do? You invented a code book, and then you used the code book to transfer the information. There are only two possibilities, so one bit was good enough to distinguish, right? Okay. Let's play the game again, except you guys are going to send them information now, okay? So it's either going to be an A, a B, or a C. Okay? Now, there's a 99.9% chance it's going to be an A. There's a 0.005% chance of a B and a 0.005% chance of a C. Okay? With me? Okay. So, you guys want to tell them about a code book you're going to use? What's your code book?
Zero should be A in the highest frequency, and then B and C would be 0, 0.
No, you're going to send them ones and zeros. These people really, I mean, they're not getting paid a lot, right? They're getting paid a dollar. They're, what are they going to do? They're going to carry a one or a zero. I mean, what do you...
So zero is A. One is B.
What? Yeah,
but if he, it's a variable length, then you have to know when it stops, right?
Right.
Okay, so you see the problem, right?
Not that we addressed that, though, because you can have zero meaning the stop character.
No, zero is not.
Hold on a second. So you see the problem, right? You see what's confusing here. This is exactly what's confused all of you. Okay, so here's a simple solution you could use. We're always going to send you two bits. 0, 0 will be A, 0, 1 will be B, 1, 0 will be C, and we just won't use 1, 1. Yeah? And look, what's that going to cost? Two bits every time, right? If I had even more characters, you could extend this, right? But if I told you it would be one of 256 characters, you'd have to send 8 bits, right? It's really straightforward. With me? Okay. So it's an easy solution. But it's more expensive than another strategy I can think of.
Right, it's not compressed.
Well, it's compressed down to 2 bits. It's compressed in some sense. It used to be 8 bits when we started, right?
So it's 0 is A, 1, 0 is B, 1, 1 is C, and if they're mostly A. And if they see one person and another, they're getting another character, and they just decode it.
Because ASCII did this, and they used 8 bits to write the alphabet. So he has to write the alphabet.
Hold on a second. So Greg's got an idea. Okay. Let's try Greg's idea and see if it works. So you say, if it's an A, you're going to send them a zero. Right. And stop. Then they're going to know if they get a zero, there ain't nothing after it. Because the code book has nothing that starts with a zero except zero. And then, if it's a one you send first, they have to look at the next bit to see if it's a 0 or a 1, in which case it's a B or a C. That's your code book, right?
Okay.
So you think that you can tell them which character it was using this code book. Yeah? Let's try. Now, all you can tell them is the bits you want to send. What are they?
0 and 0.
What do you think? What did you get?
Two A's.
Two A's.
Are you convinced that we could have done more complicated things and they would have worked? Yes?
Okay. So that's the idea. If I tell you the probability distribution of the numbers you're going to encode, these are much more likely, these are much less likely, you can come up with a variable length code that will give short codes to common things and long codes to uncommon things. If you want to do this over the entire 256 characters, some of the codes are going to be longer than 8 bits, because some of them are shorter than 8 bits. But the average code will be, if you do it well, shorter than 8 bits. And if you do it poorly, longer than 8 bits. I mean, some are better than others. And there's a fellow that came up with the optimal way to do it, and his name was Huffman, and so we call it a Huffman code. Is if I tell you the probability distribution, what code you should use. Got it? Okay, now there's some extra complexity of, you know, so how do we decide which things we're going to send? Oh, we'll send differences, we'll sort them in a certain order, right? All that builds on top of the basic ability to send you less data and have you get the same information. It's almost like magic. Yeah, I mean, think about it. If I could do this, why couldn't I take the resulting bits and encode them and save even more and eventually get down to nothing? What's that? Yeah, I'll just send you one and it will mean everything. All human numbers. One. Right? And it turned out the reason you can't do that is because the initial distribution of the characters you might send in this game we've been playing was sharply skewed. But the distribution of bits in the game we were playing was, in the Huffman code, as close to 50-50 as can be arranged, given the fact that there is some discreteness to this. Yeah? So you can't encode it further. That's what makes Huffman optimal. You can get there in one step.
Even if it's language or the probability that that is still occurring, how the distribution is
excellent question. So, if there is some unmodeled feature, like what's the probability these two characters appear in this order, then your code is no longer optimal, because you could have encoded character pairs. Right? So the code is optimal only with respect to what you're trying to encode, which is why it made a difference how you pre-processed the data before you encoded it. So you pre-processed the data so that the variation is small, right? So that you pre-process the data so the skew is large, right? So you have a few things that are very common. So if I have a set of document IDs, I pre-process it so that I start by looking at the difference between the document IDs rather than the document IDs themselves. So one document might have a very large number, but one document ID to another document ID, if I can sort them in a good order, will tend to be a small number. So the encoding small number is more often the large number. So I try to force the skew high so that I can then get a tight code. And that's the same trick you would play with anything. Make sense? Okay. Other questions on this? One last point plays to the same thing. One of the questions that got asked when I do one. One of the questions I got asked was, I'm not sure I understand this space-time trade-off, this idea of, you know, saving how big the index gets or any of that. That's the most important thing we talked about last time. So that's the right question to focus on. The basic idea in information retrieval for speed, not for effectiveness, for speed, is that I'm going to take the information in which the terms are in documents, and I'm going to invert it so that I have the documents associated with terms. I can index them by terms.
So instead of a document being the thing that holds terms, a term is the thing that holds documents. All right.
So then we need to convert the index.
Absolutely. So when I do that, I can do that in a way that permits very, very fast access. That's how Google gets so fast. But if I want very fast access, I have to use lots of disk space. I have to store more information on disk than I would if I wanted slower access. All right, so I have to pay in space to save in time. Now, the specific way we do that is with a B plus tree, right? So this is a computer science data structure that uses up more space to give faster, not just access, but updates. Rapid access and rapid updates. That detail is not so important. It's really important that we're trading space for time. So we're going to get fast performance, but it's going to cost us something. We don't get something for nothing. We have to spend time. Just as with the compression, we had to go from a fixed length code, which was sort of easy to understand and easy to program on a computer for, to a variable length code, which is harder to understand and the computer takes more time to process. So the computer handles bytes at a time. So we're not getting something for nothing, but what we're getting is very valuable to us, which is rapid access. A second thing, okay, there's one more point. The disk is very, very, very slow compared with the main memory in the computer. And somebody said, I'm not sure I understand this disk versus main memory thing, and that's fine. Come see me and we can talk about it. It's a concept from the prerequisite course, basic information technology course of how the computer's organized and what the speeds are and all these things. So I don't want to go back over that concept now, but there are components that operate at different speeds. The difference is not a factor of two, it's a factor of a million. So it makes an enormous difference how you get these things allocated to the different parts of the machine. The very fast things are very small. The very slow things are very big. If you think about it, it couldn't be any other way. Because the very fast things, well, if the very fast things could be made very large, you wouldn't have to make this distinction. So the fact that there is a distinction means that in one case you've got something optimized for size, and in another case you have something optimized for speed, for dot. So we have to be careful how we split that up, and it turns out that the inverted file structure has two parts. Look up the terms, of which there's only about 100,000 of them, and look up the documents, of which there's only every document ever written by humanity. So look up the documents is going to happen on disk, and it's really good for you if look up the terms can happen in memory, which it couldn't until about 10 years ago. But now it can. That the memory is plenty large for the size of it. Got the idea there? So this is fundamental, is that there is this time-space trade-off. And the consequence of the time-space trade-off is going to haunt us all semester. We pay no attention to the order of the words. All we know is this word was used, and so was that one. And that's it. Now, if you're willing to let go of your preconceived notions about language and just let the description of a document be the words that are in it, then the question is, how well can you do subject to that limitation? Because you can do that limitation really fast. That was our fundamental requirement, was we have to be able to do this fast. So that's why I start with indexing. Yeah.
So would paying attention to the order of the words be more of an NLP kind of thing, or is it just a topic we're not addressing? It's an information retrieval?
Oh, no. If you could do better information retrieval by paying attention to the order of the words, that would be great.
That would fit into memory.
Well, ultimately, you'd have to show me it could fit into memory. First, you'd have to show me it was useful. And once you could show me it was useful, then we could try to figure out some clever algorithm to get in memory. So the fundamental question in information retrieval is, does it work? And if it works, we'll say next week what we mean by does it work. But if it works well, then we'll think about how to make it efficient. There's no sense having it be efficient if it's not effective. Okay? So we start out, we say, look, we know this indexing thing is efficient, and I'll show you how to make it effective. Now you show me some system that's more effective, I'll work with you on how to make it more efficient. But I start by, I need to handle the whole web, so it's convenient for me to think about individual words. What answer?
If we're only paying attention to individual words, how does Google do phrase searching?
So here's a really simple way to do it. You do individual word searching, you get back a bunch of documents, and you quickly check to see if those documents have the words in the right order and next to each other. So people actually do that. Google has
like
the actual
subset search.
Right. So you get you use the basic trick to get the subset, and then within the subset, some subset of it has got the words in order. Now, that's not what Google actually does, but that would work. What Google actually does is it keeps track of the position of the word in the document in some cases. If it did in every case, it'd have to pay a lot to store that. So they probably don't do it in every case, but certainly keeping track of it in the case of very uncommon words wouldn't add a lot of cost because they don't occur very often in the document. You wouldn't keep track of every position of the, right? For now, if you do a search for Smokey the Bear, I know where Smokey is, I know where Bear is, I don't even retrieve the set in the first place if they're not near each other, and then I can check to see if the's in the pretty cheaply. Right? So it's a combination of those two that actually gets used. So I build it out of simple components.
I'll advise you to get more lexicism for what you were saying. Appendix, the results of the appendix for folks, what they're doing to improve the chances of you if you search for a phrase. Because the doctor and appendix in it, they probably have that one in terms of the location of the word. So that you get the right appendix, the right information there.
If I search for doctor and appendix,
right,
then
conceptually.
Well, so if I search for a phrase, I'm going to get those words in order and nothing else. Right? I mean, that's a Boolean search. Give me everything with these words in order.
Okay.
And don't give me anything else. You get a set of documents.
Okay, so that's different than the phrase search.
No, so that is a phrase search. Right? You gave me a phrase. Doctor cut my appendix. Quote, got to find exactly that. Then what we do is we just index each one of those words. We pull them back, see if they're near each other. If the index has recorded their position, we use that. Otherwise, we go through the documents to see if they're near each other. And then I've got that set of words, right? A user will use that function to focus. So there's this question in homework one that said, what's your ability to control the trade-off between comprehensiveness and precision? So that's a kind of a function that will allow control of a greater precision. Right? The fundamental capability exists, but the machine doesn't do anything on your behalf. The user has to decide they want to see those words together in an order. And if they do say that, they don't get the words nearby each other. They just get them together in an order. Now what Google does is it gives extra weight to words that occur nearby. And extra weight to words that occur in the right order. So you can actually take a Google search and put your words in backwards and you get different answers in some cases. But that's where we're going tonight. How do we rank order things? Any other questions? So the other thing I want to do is talk about homework one.
You guys did just a phenomenal good job on homework one.
Alright, so I've had a chance to look through all of them now. I've looked through some of them in great detail. I've looked through others sort of skimming to see if you picked up things other people didn't. And it's an impressive range of style that you adopted for doing that. So I want you each to look at each other's homework, and I'll put up tonight a webpage and link it from the class webpage of the homework answers for homework one, which I threatened to do that I would do. So if you don't want your homework exposed, send me a note quickly. Right now. But you should look at it because when we talk about evaluation, that's what you were doing. You were doing evaluation of search systems. And I was actually surprised by some of the answers. It was a very consistent preference for the Ellis Island search system, which is one of the hardest search problems
but people found very nice things to say about how they had approached this hard problem. And there was quite a lot of dissing of the University of Texas system, which is also a very hard search problem, searching for people, and there was a lot of pointing out its flaws. Now, the other interesting thing, and something that you really should make note of yourself, is that there was no system that had zero support. Every system had some people that really liked it. Now, in part, this reflects the fact that people in this class bring different backgrounds. You brought different interpretations of some of the questions, right? Some of the terminology I was using, like recall and precision, people interpreted differently because they hadn't encountered that terminology before, used in the way I meant it, and so they said something different on a detailed point. That's all fine. But the overall conclusion people reached were different because people envisioned different needs, different uses. People brought different backgrounds, people brought different ideas of what kinds of questions would be asked. So you're going to go out and design a system in your project. And when you do that, you have to realize that the people who are going to use it don't think the way you do. And to see that, look at how the people in the class responded to the same question you responded to and gave exactly the opposite answer. And then justified their position just as you had justified yours. Right? So it's really well worth it to go through that because it'll show you the limitations of some of what we do in evaluation when we get that. Okay. So, there was one other point I wanted to make about the homework. Let me just see. Oh, I like the Olympic scoring. There are several people that have seven. I really like some people work from examples. So people said, well, I'm supposed to tell you whether this would be good for new users. I imagine a new user might ask a question like this, you know, and then they would use that to illustrate their answer. So that's a really good way to explore things. There's somebody who called that use cases. That was a really nice sort of naming of it. There were two people who didn't send it in on time. And there was one person who sent it to my spam filter instead of to me. Now, the person who sent it to my spam filter, not your problem, my problem when I fixed it. But the two people who didn't send it in on time, I had to think, oh my gosh, what do I do? I'm using a hard F on grading. But it just doesn't seem right the first time. So, 1 point off if you're late, any amount late on the first assignment, and 1 point off per day on every assignment after that. Don't be late. Yeah. So all I asked for this time was to put it on your web page. But last time, people sent me things like Microsoft Word files, you know, a link to a Microsoft Word file. And so it'd be a little hard for you to add something to a Microsoft Word file. So it's fine if people send it to me again. And in fact, almost everybody did send it to me again. But I will simply go to the web page that you sent me last time and look for it if you haven't sent me an email telling me to look something like this. Okay? Okay.
So you're okay if we posted a Word document?
I'm okay if we posted, yeah. I had people sending me Excel spreadsheets for the first assignment. Because it was a really nice way to organize a table. Right. So anything you want. Okay, good. So, what this week?
Well, just let me go.
If you don't wish to post things on the web, it's okay with me. I've asked that things be posted on the web, and if you send me a note that says, I don't want my stuff on the web, I'll just send it to you privately, that'll be fine. You want to do a project and you want to say, I'm working on this thing and, you know, I'm going to patent it when we're done, so I don't want everybody to know about it, that's fine. So I will ask, generally, that things be public because I think we all learn from each other really well. But if you have some good reason for not wanting to do that, you don't even have to tell all of us what it is. You send me a note and you say, I don't want my stuff linked, I don't want my stuff on the web. You know, I mean, people sent me homework with their name in it. Okay, well, your name's going to be linked to a web page that says you took this last. Might be embarrassed by that several years from now, right? So you know, it's a good question. Okay? So just let me know if you don't want it. Okay, so I want to talk this week about rank retrieval. Now look, we talked about Boolean search last week almost by accident. I wanted to show you how we get from words all the way up to search. So I started with words, or I'm sorry, started with characters all the way up to search. I started with characters, and I got all the way up to terms, which could be lots of different things. And then I showed you how we use them. But I just showed you one way of using them. And one of the things you were frustrated with was, but wait a minute, don't I want to give some things more weight and other things less weight? And the answer is, well, sure. Well, but how? And so this week, I want to talk about why and then how. So we'll start out talking generally about rank retrieval. Don't know why anybody. And then similarity-based ranking, probability-based ranking are two ways to rank. So here's what motivates us. Let's say you have a question for which the answers can be found in the collection. Now, if that's not true, nothing we do is going to work. Right? So my starting point is, let's say the answers actually exist in some documents. Now, imagine for a moment you know which documents they are. This is unrealistic, but just imagine you know which documents they are. Then you could find exactly those documents and no others. Almost always with the following Boolean query. The first word in the first document, and the second word in the first document, and the third word in the first document. All the way up to, and the last word in the first document, and not the first other word in the language, the second other word in the language, the third other word in the language, all the way up to the last other word in the language, right? That would retrieve, y'all got to believe me on this, the first document and nothing else. I mean, if anybody happens to be trying to screw you up by playing one of those games where you take the words and you put them in some other order, and it produces a completely different document, okay, we'll get screwed up by that one. But otherwise, this is going to work, right? You with me? Okay. Or, so all that in parentheses. Or, do it again for the second document. Or, do it again for the third document. Right? You with me? This will produce the set of documents you want. Now, I don't mean to imply that we should teach people how to build queries. Right. I mean, this is useless knowledge that such a thing can be done, because nobody could do it without having seen the documents, and if you've seen the document, you don't need the query, right? But you'd have to now agree with me that there exists a perfect query. It exists, right? By construction, I can construct the perfect query. The only problem with Boolean retrieval is the user. Right? The problem with Boolean retrieval is the user because there is a perfect query. Boolean retrieval is therefore perfect. Every other approach to retrieval must be worse. Or at least can't be any better because Boolean retrieval is perfect. It's the Boolean users that aren't perfect, right? Because they can't make up perfect queries. Not that perfect queries don't exist. It's just, we ain't got no way of finding it. With me? Okay, so, we have to stop thinking about how to make a better search engine. We already have a perfect search engine. Right? The problem is, how do we make a more useful search engine? Right? So we're going to make a weaker search engine. One that's not perfect. In exchange for making it more useful. That's the game. Okay? So, Boolean queries have a problem. Let's see if I've got a slide for that. Yeah. Okay. So they're good, if you know the right strategies, you can get an awful lot out of them. I mean, we're going to skip over the strategies, but LBFC 650, LBFC 750 talk about strategies for forming Boolean queries, and we can talk about them if you're interested. But it takes training to do this well, and even if you do it well, you can't do it perfectly. They're very efficient to implement, which is why all the early systems were built that way. So there's both. But it's very, very common when you form your first Boolean query that you get no documents at all. Now, people saw this in the homework today. Or that you get so many documents you couldn't look through them for the rest of your life. And so, if you're a well-trained Boolean searcher, you know how to adapt your query when that occurs to you. But if you're a clever machine, you know when there are no documents, right? I mean, the machine knows how many documents it's giving you. Why not have it adapt the query for you? And say, you know, didn't find anything with this spelling, let's try that spelling, right? Google does that for you. People seem to get along with that. So that's going to be the idea. We're going to try to make something that's more flexible than Boolean queries. And so the way we're going to do it is we're going to say, okay, this zero hit problem is a real problem. So when we see it, we'll just give you more. And in fact, since we don't know if we're going to get zero hits before we start, we'll just give you more to begin with. And then we'll sort it so the best stuff's on top, then you can stop looking wherever you feel like it. So you can be just as precise as you would have been with the Boolean query if you just look at the top of the list. And if you have the patience to go further down the list, there's more there. Why should I ever stop showing you stuff? There's something that's not as good as the thing before, but better than nothing. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to do a very broad search, and we're going to then rank it in best first order. Okay, so you can see the strengths and weaknesses, and these are pretty much as we've talked about. Now, the reason this technique that we're going to talk about tonight works is because the search box is not what finds the documents. What finds the documents is the user who formed the query and who selected things off the list and decided it was what they wanted. So we're going to put much more emphasis here and much less emphasis here. Now, you remember in the first week, this graph, this slide, had two horizontal bars on it. And one of them said predict, nominate, and choose. And so this part up here is about predicting. This part here is a machine that does the nomination, and this part here is about choosing it. People are really good at choosing. In fact, they're so good at choosing that we have a phrase for this. We say, I'll know it when I see it, right? The reason why we say that so much is because we will, right? People are really good at that. But they're really bad at understanding the internals of how the system works and learning the query language and thinking of all the ways somebody might have used terminology, all those things involved in predicting. So predicting is hard, recognizing is easy, and what we're going to do is we're going to take the work and we're going to move it from here, where instead of having a library school to learn how to make a good query, we're going to move it over here, where you got to like be born and be a human and, you know, be able to recognize what you're looking for. Okay? Now, we can't move it completely. The machine's got to have some clue what it is you're looking for. And so what we're going to do is we're going to have the world's easiest query formulation. We're going to put a little box, write Google on top of it, all right? And you put anything in the box you like. And we'll find you stuff about that. So all you're going to do is you can give us words. You just can give me a bunch of words, and I'm going to do the best I can. Okay? See where we're going. Okay. So, I'm not going to change the representation function. I'm going to use the same representation function we used before. I'm not going to change the index. I mean, I'll put a little extra stuff in it. It's going to be basically what you saw. I'm just going to count the terms. I'm going to keep the counts now. Somebody was bugged by us doing one and zeros last time. You'll feel much better tonight. Or you like integers. Right? One, two, three. The number of times it happens. That's all we're going to change. Right? We're not even going to do proximity. Trust is going to change, just going to count the numbers. But I'm going to change the comparison function, because the comparison function before was all that Boolean logic, and, or, not, right? So we're just going to change that to be something we do with the counts. Now, what will we do with the counts? Well, it's written right there. We're going to go give it a log, and then we're going to sum it up, right? So we're actually going to do that to the counts. And that's why there were all those formulas. Because ultimately, we want to come up with a number, and the number says, this document's good, or this document's bad. If it's good, we want a high number, and if it's bad, we want a small number, and we'll just sort them in the order of the score that we get from the document. So we've taken a hard problem, find the user what they want, really underspecified, and we said, look, I'm just going to take, now listen to this carefully, all the documents in the world, all the documents I know of, and I'm going to sort them. I'm not actually going to ever decide. If you want to look at the last one on the list, you're welcome to do it. It's document number 406,324,436,302. Right? You can look at it if you want to. But you've got to look at 436 billion so on before it, because they're in order, and you're sitting here, it's next page, and the next 10 come up. Right? So, in practice, the ones way down at the bottom are so far down, nobody will ever get there. So we will save ourselves a little trouble by not bothering with them. Right? So we will make some chopping off. And ultimately, we'll do a chopping off at the very last line in the class. We'll chop it off at just the right point. But for now, there's no chopping going on. We're just going to sort every document. That means I just have to tell you the score for every document. And then it's pretty obvious. I'm just putting more. With me? Yes?
When you said, what is the term of the score? Like, in that way, like Google, they don't wait to determine, like, they, you know, this
sure. Okay, you might have meant something different than I meant when I thought of weight. But they pay attention to the frequency. They give more weight to the ones that occur more often. Or less often. That's going to be the trick tonight, is to answer that question. Okay, so the game we're going to play is here, and the way we're going to play it is with mathematics. Except we'll try to keep the math sort of with explanations too. Okay, so the trick is we're going to perform a fairly general search. We're going to retrieve more than we need. Right? In general, you can just forget this for the first part. We're going to retrieve everything. Then we're going to rank the documents in best first order, where I don't really know what best is here, but you've got some notion of relevance from tonight's homework. We're going to try to put the relevant ones on top and the not relevant ones on the bottom. That's our goal. Okay? And the evidence we have for that is the query. And then we're going to display the middle list, but we're not going to show you the documents. We're going to show you some little surrogate for the document that allows you to decide if you want to see the whole thing. It's just the standard web search interface, right? Where you just try to make Google tonight. Okay, now, let's see, there's something else I was going to say on this. Flip my mind. So this is what we talked about.
So are we ignoring the idea of like PageRank?
Yes. Okay. For tonight, we will not get PageRank. We'll leave proximity out. We'll leave a lot of details out. So we get the basic idea of just based on the content, how good a ranking can be. And then there's a class that is evidence from behavior. Remember seeing that in the syllabus? There's evidence from content, there's evidence from behavior. So the evidence from behavior, one of the ways people behave on the net is they create links. And we can look at people's behavior, like the creation of links, and we can think of those as votes, and we can ascribe authority. They're not really votes, and it's not really indicating authority, but it's more evidence, but it's evidence from behavior, not from content. And the nice thing is, if you can figure out how to screw me up with evidence from content, I can look at the evidence from behavior. You can screw me up with that, I can look at the evidence from metadata. If you can screw me up with that, well, I can look at a pair of them. And so eventually I'm going to look at all three of them. People do. So we have to get like 10 weeks into the class before you see the whole picture. So tonight we're going to take a soda screw view. We're just going to try to rank it based on concept. Okay? Okay. Now, this is a bad idea. Bruce Croft, who's one of the father figures of information control, wrote an article in which he identified what users want. He started a small company, made a retrieval system, tried to sell it, and from this learned what the marketplace was demanding. And it turns out the marketplace is inconsistent because users are inconsistent because people are inconsistent, right? But what people want is they want systems that work really well. So he called this magic. Yeah, we don't know how to build it, but they want magic, right? They just, you know, have a thought and here's my answer, right? They also want to be able to understand how this darn thing works. So we ran a bunch of user studies, and one of the things the users told us was, like, a better explanation of how it works, please, so that we can figure out how to use it better. So users want to understand it, and they want magic. Now think about it. What's the characteristic of magic? It's what you don't understand, right? So people really do want both of these. They're both real, but they're inconsistent with each other. Okay, think of that. So when we do this fancy ranking, even after you've seen the math, you won't know what the darn thing did in any one case, because there's so many details being kept track of. Boolean search, you don't find it, whose fault is it? Yours. You're the one that made the query, right? Branch retrieval, you don't find it. Oh, well, it's supposed to put the best stuff first, and it didn't. Now what do I do? I'll add a few more words to my query. What would I do? I don't know, but it'll do something different, right? So there's a real problem here that we're taking a system people understood and we're making it less understandable. And that means we better make it one heck of a lot better so that the first time through, it gets them someplace. Because otherwise, we haven't improved anything. We've just made it less understandable and we got 15 papers out of it, right? So we're academically famous, but nobody will ever use it. And that happened here. That happened for 2 decades. People were doing academic research on this, and nobody would use it. And the reason nobody would use it is because the customers for search technology were highly trained searchers. He knew how to use the Boolean stuff and who didn't understand this. And so you made the supposedly better stuff, they didn't understand this, and they didn't use it. Not a mistake. That's the right thing for them to have done. But then along came a whole new group of searchers who didn't have the training. And for them, a little magic was a good thing. And that created the web search engine industry. And all that happened was one professor at Carnegie Mellon had a little extra time one summer, and he wrote a program that took well-known stuff that we'll talk about tonight, and just use it on web pages. And that created the Lycos search engine, which was actually the third one in that people had done things before that. But that was the first large-scale search engine. And so it was because we shifted the user that we got the adoption. The adoption came from a different set of users. This is often the case that you get a technology invented. It goes on for a long time without really having much impact on the world. Some spark occurs, it takes off, and then ultimately it goes down. Yes, ma'am. Come to the class last year. So this is the IR version. You all having fun or do you want to break? Or both? What's that?
It's okay, you can continue.
Okay. Now you know who to blame. So, I want to do rank retrieval. Here's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it using Boolean retrieval. So you give me a query. Let's say that your query is, let's just use a specific example, information retrieval. Now, if I use information and retrieval, and I realize you didn't say and, you just said information retrieval. Just typed information retrieval into Google, and Google is now going to rank for you. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. It doesn't matter. Here's how it's going to be done. If you said information and retrieval, I would have found you all of these documents that had information and retrieval. So these are actual titles of books and information retrieval. If you said information and not retrieval, you would have gotten these. And if you said retrieval and not information, you would have gotten these. All of them are on top. Right? So that's how I'll rank them. You say information retrieval, I give you everything with both, then everything with one. And then, conceptually, everything else. Now, I can't tell you what order, I mean, I could what order I put this one in. You can after all these before all those. But I can't tell you what order I put these in. I have no way of telling them. You see this idea? This is partial match ranking. You give me a query, I'll satisfy the query, and then I'll satisfy parts of the query for you. All the way down to the point where I'm satisfying almost none of the query, and the last thing I do is I satisfy none of your query. And you're welcome to look at those documents too if you like. Yeah.
Are these ranked?
Yeah, so this one's first, this set. And I can't tell you the order within the set, but I can tell you this set comes before this set. And this set comes before that.
Now, I'm asking about the internal ranking.
No.
Those ranking, not yet.
No. So I've now got some kind of ranking here. You start to get the idea that things with everything you ask for should be at the top, and things with some of what you ask for lower down, things with less of what you ask for even further down. So this actually is a ranked retrieval system. Not really a very good one yet. Yes? Okay. And so this idea is called partial match ranking. And you simply do it this way. You form all the possible result sets. First you add all the terms, then you add all the first, then all the second, blah, 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 then all the first two, all the second two, you get the idea, right? Okay. And then you remove any duplicates from subsequent sets because everything that's in the end of all but the first is also in this first set. So you have to remove duplicates. And then you display the sets in the order they're made, and you do anything you like inside from the sets. Got it? Okay, so you know how to do rank retrieval. We can take a break. And when we pick up, I'll show you how we really do rank retrieval. So, I cheated you last week. You only got a 3-minute break at the end, so you got a 12-minute break. Well, in case you didn't hear it last week, there are studies that show that if you sit during the breaks, you're more likely to fall asleep during the next session. And we will actually run an experiment on this. So we'll see who sat, and if you fall asleep, we'll hang a little sign on it. Count to the end.
projects which we are supposed to do these three options, means are there some sort of software we will be given option to use?
There's on the course page, there is a list of different systems you can use, like the game you mentioned.
It's like basically say using Google search engine with their API codes for our phone.
Well, I think it's sort of like using Java. There's some functions built into it. It's not like using I mean, you start to implement some aspects of it, but you should go over that with doing or commission. Oh yeah, okay. It's under, if you go to the course page,
yeah.
Go under information retrieval resources.
Okay. Yeah.
And
you are
in. You see in green that there. So you can use any of them.
Thank you.
to write an algorithm starting with me. We have listed many tools like Google, Screen, and other Java based tutorials, and we have to use them.
Yeah, you could. Can you do that after 8:25? I got too many graphs on the board, all right?
We have so well otherwise.
Okay, so what we've done so far is we talked about the idea of rank retrieval, the whys and wherefores of the rank retrieval concept. We're going to talk now about how to do rank retrieval one way. And this is the way that was indeed developed back in the late 60s, early 70s. And it survived up until about 1997 as the only really effective way. Other people tried other things, but they were just tweaks around this. They were mostly, you know, get academic for anything. And then, in 1998, three groups simultaneously published a different way of doing it that actually worked. And it didn't work better, but it was better developed. It was explained in a way that made it clear how to make the system better. So that became sort of a new starting point. The last one sort of ran out of steam. It had been optimized as much as it could, and this has given us a new starting point. So this is the fresh new stuff at the end, but it's a little bit easier to come at the idea through similarity-based ranking, and most of what's presently out there is similarity-based ranking. And one of the things that the probability-based people keep bemoaning is every time they come up with a better idea, the similarity-based people say, well, if we think about it this way, we can do it in our similarity-based system, you know, just as well. So the similarity-based people keep stealing the probability-based people's ideas, right? So the basic idea is that this is a good way to get insight, and this is a really good way to actually find topics. Okay, now we're going to start throwing around lots of terminology and equations and stuff like that. And so I've tried to sprinkle in here a little bit of what's really going on. Just stop and ask if we get sort of off the reservation and it's not making sense. So start off with a model, because we're going to talk about different models. We'll talk about models all the time. So a model is nothing but a way of looking at things. It's a perspective on the world. So we can think of modeling a person by their height and weight. And you see this on driver's license, right? That's a model of you. And so I can check to see if that's you. I think if the appearance looks that way, if the height and weight, they're about right, that sort of thing. So a model is necessarily incomplete. Yeah, we've made some simplifying assumptions, the world isn't really that way. It's not true that all people are the same height and weight as the same person, but it is useful to model people by height and weight. So if it's useful, that's the test of whether it's a good model, not whether it's right. All models are wrong, because all models are incomplete. So we're going to make models, and we're going to use models to sort documents. Okay. Now, here's the modeling step in this first approach. We're going to model relevance as similarity. So if I want to know if something is relevant to a query, I'm going to ask, is it similar to the query? And if it's similar to the query, I'm going to say, fine. Then I believe it's relevant to the query by the degree of similarity. Now, that's wrong. But it's useful, because now we can, you going to do a vector space for it?
Actually, have a graph, I think.
Can you do that? You really have to like, be an octopus.
Wasn't last week the vectors didn't have infinite direction, and now all of a sudden we're finding the cosine? Yeah.
Okay. So, we're going to model relevance to similarity, and then we'll just rank documents by similarity to the rank documents by the similarity to the query. Now, the way that we're going to do that, we're going to take a step further. We're going to treat the query as if it were a document. It's just a really short document in most cases. And then, if we had some way of saying whether two documents were similar, that would tell us whether any given document is similar to the query. So, just to simplify my life, forget about the query. We're just going to now talk about whether two documents are similar. Okay? And then later we'll just apply it with one of them together. Okay, so that's the entire game. So here's a simple example with Boolean vectors. So just like you saw last time, except now we're going to do random. So let's say I have the three documents, nuclear fallout, contaminated Montana, which if you saw the Washington Post yesterday, isn't too far from real. Information retrieval is interesting, which is flashy, you must believe. Information retrieval is complicated, which apparently was the message from last week. So these three documents, those terms, these terms appearing in that document, and I've just left the zeros as blanks so they're a little easier to see visually, right? But what's missing is would be difference. Okay, so if we have that, then I can ask how similar are some documents. So here's a simple way to compute it. I can count the number of terms they have in common. And that will tell me how similar the documents are. If they have no terms in common, they're not similar at all. If all the terms are the same, they're very similar. Right? Okay. So documents 2 and 3 share two common terms. Alright, this one and that one. So documents 2 and 3 have a similarity of 2. Documents 1 and 2 share no terms at all. So, documents 1 and 2 have a similarity of 0. Okay? So, if I take document 2 as the query, I would put document 3 ahead of document 1. Alright? Pretty simple. Yes? No sigmas. Well, actually, there's a sigma there, but we sort of glossed over it. We counted up the number. Okay. So this is actually useful if you want to do more like this queries, right? I found a document, I want to find more documents like this, people actually do this. Have you ever seen a technique like this before? Yeah.
Amazon.com?
Say more.
You purchase a book and it'll give you recommendations.
Oh, people like this book also like that book.
Right, or even the same author, so they show, or if you're added to your wish list,
mm-hmm.
Add to your wish list, and then there are other books that have the same commonality.
Okay. So indeed, it's using this exact same idea to find other books that have the same pattern of purchasers. So it's using purchasers as if they were terms.
Right.
Right?
Okay.
That behavioral ranking we were talking about, which we'll come to.
Google use option in their search, similar pages or similar results.
Yes. Okay. So those are applications outside this class. Have you ever seen inside this class a technique like this before? How many rank retrieval models do you know so far? Do you know the partial match Boolean and this? Good. So, do you know any that are similar to this one? So what's similar about it? I mean, it's a good guess, right? Because it's the only other one you know.
They take the terms and match to the document. So if the document contains the terms, but when you're building the Boolean, so it'll say, you know, document one and document two, right? I'm trying to explain that, it's not very well.
No, you got it perfect. So if I had information retrieval as my query document, then I would rank everything that had two terms in common with my query ahead of everything that had no terms in common with my query, right? So remember when people were asking last time, okay, but how do I actually do it? So this was the idea. And this is how you actually do it. This does partial match retrieval. Using the term document anchor. It's the same idea. I just taught you exactly the same idea twice. One time with a lot of hand waving, and the other time with a lot of annoying matrices. Right? It's the same idea. And so that's what we need to do all the way through. We need to keep in mind that everything has an annoying level of detail and some really big hand waving thing that Alistair was trying to imitate earlier. Right? And so keep in mind both. We'll look at both in lots of details. Okay. So here's the picture. For every document, I'm going to make a vector. Now I want you to think of a vector in a physical sense, not a bunch of ones and zeros, but a direction of space. Okay? Now here's how we're going to get the vector. Let's say that I have three dimensions. Right? So I've got every document is about birds, fish, or cats. Right? And some of them are mostly about birds. Three birds. One fish. No cats, so I don't have to jump. Okay? You get the idea? I'm going to count out this way for my first term. Then I'm going to go over that way for my second term. And the direction is going to be from where I started to where I ended. Okay? Now, if I have one bird and two fish, I'll have a vector over this way. Now you can see that as my documents get longer, I'm going to be outside the wall after a while. All right? So short documents, short vectors. Long documents, long vectors. It turns out there are about 100,000 dimensions, so your visualization ability is going to break down after
each term is a direction.
Each term is a direction. Right? And every direction is orthogonal or perpendicular to every other direction. Right? So here's the first direction. There's a second direction over this way. There's a third direction. And, well, time marches forward. Maybe we think about it as a fourth dimension. And, you know, after that, we're in science fiction, right?
So it doesn't matter which order you intend the terms, because each term has some direction. And when you do cross or over.
That's right, which means I can arbitrarily sort the order of my terms. And I still get the same effect.
The query of the document, you don't have to have the terms in the same order.
Well, the query of the document have to have the terms in the same order. Yes. Because I have to have them in the same space. So, remember I had birds, fish, and cats?
Yeah.
Birds have to be in the same direction as birds all the time.
Right.
I got birds in the documents are in this direction, but birds in the queries are in the direction. We're really in trouble.
The order in which the query is submitted does not match the word on which the word is in the document, because
I'm just
going one. Two in the verb direction.
Did I do
one
that?
One in the tense direction, same going one in the tense direction and two in the verb direction.
Perfect. Yes.
So this, when you say they have to be in the same order, it's because you're sorting the query and you're sorting the terms of the document.
So my representation has to be
right.
I have to have the same meaning to, my term has to mean this away. But I don't have to move that away for it. In practice, we don't do any of this. There's no little man in the door.
I won't see that if it's open the door on the computer.
No, that's what all that stuff over there is. Okay, but this is the intuition. So remember I told you there's an intuition and there's an implementation. So this is the intuition. You with me? So what we're going to do is we're going to take every document in the collection and we're going to paste it on the firmament. Now, anybody who's studied astronomy knows about the celestial sphere, right? We act as if there's a sphere, and we move all the stars to that same sphere, to that distance, right? So we have a sphere of unit length one, and if the document is really long, the arrow goes through the sphere, so just kind of pull it right back down. Then everything's on the sphere. So now I can think like I'm in a planetary, right? My documents are stars. This actually works pretty well because people tend to write lots of documents on the same thing. No documents yet written on this other thing. So we have our stars clumped in galaxies. And this actually is not a bad sort of visualization. In fact, I know people who've taken this and with mathematical tricks projected it down to three dimensions, gotten the little 3D glasses, made a little fish tank virtual reality thing where you can reach in and pick up the documents and move them around and take your lightsaber and point at a document. Right? So I know people who've built this stuff. So you can do that. So the idea that we're operating on a celestial sphere, I got my documents up here as stars and they form into galaxies, that's not bad. And now you come along as a searcher and you've got a query and you go out in some direction. And we find out what you hit. Well, you don't hit anything exactly, probably, I mean, unless you're a really good aim. But you probably find some stuff nearby. And there's some stuff further out. And there's some stuff further out than that. And the further it is from your query, the lower it is in the rank. Now, one way to think about this, which I really like, is we're going to take the celestial sphere, and we're going to let the air out of the blue. It's going to be down before. So it's just this is the surface of the celestial sphere. But now it's just essentially a big flat fishing net. So this is, in mathematics, called manifold, the surface of a high-dimensional space. Okay, so we take the manifold, and we project it. We treat it as a flat. Now it's a fishing net, and I can take my query, and that's a spot in the fishing net. Remember, that was a spot I shot. So I've got a spot in the fishing net, and I'm going to pick it up. And the fishing net's going to hang from whatever spot I picked it up at, right? And the further down it hangs, that's the ranking. That's the game, right? So we're going to find out how far away it is on the sphere. Right? And the picking up the fishing net is kind of a nice way of thinking about it, because it shows you how it hangs as a ranking. But on the sphere, it's just a set of concentric circles increasing size. Same, right?
How do you locate that point? Since you have flattened.
Oh, yes. So I skipped over. I have no idea how to do that. I just sort of imagined that I could do it. I'll tell you how I do it on the sphere. Okay. So so that's the basic game. Stop there and go to the next. So just kind of keep that in the back of your mind. And we're going to sneak up on that through mathematics. So if we want to know about a term, I showed you this last time, terms tell us about documents. So remember, this was a document about McDonald's. How do we know? It said McDonald's a lot. It was a term about McDonald's saying things. How do we know? It said said. Now, I don't know if this is things McDonald's said or if things were said about McDonald's, but I know this is a document about saying things. This is a document about fat and fries and new and you get the idea, right? Well, these are simply the dimensions. And we're just going to go out 12 says and over 14 McDonald's, or 16 says over 14 McDonald's, up 12 flat, fats, L3 for I is equal to MU, right? So we're going to make this 100,000 dimensional space. It's going to be zero in most of the dimensions, so it's going to be really flat and squishy if you think about it in 100,000 dimensions, but it's going to have some structure to it that will fill out, you know, some part of the space. Okay? Alright, so if rabbit appears a lot, it might be about rabbits. If McDonald's appears a lot, it might be about McDonald's. Terms tell us about documents, you shouldn't be surprised. Documents tell us about terms. So if I asked you, I'm searching for Monica Lewinsky. Did I do this example before in class? No. Okay, so I'm searching for Monica Lewinsky. Here's the deal. You get to pick one of those terms into your search. And then you just have to look at every document that comes back. Right? You can either pick Monica or Lewinsky. Which one are you going to pick? You know, you guys don't agree on much. What's so good about Lewinsky?
It's more discriminating.
It's more discriminating?
Yes.
Yes? Okay. So I really like, if I'm searching, specific terms, yes? If you learn this, if you learn to construct Boolean queries, right, you start with highly specific terms. Or you add more specific terms if you want to narrow your search. So here's how I'm going to find out if a term is really specific. If it occurs in only one document, it's really specific. If it occurs in every document, it's not very specific. Do you think that will work with Monica Lewinsky? Will it tell me that Lewinsky is more specific than Monica? You bet. Right? So, if I have this table that tells me complicated appears 5 times in document 3, and 4 times in document 2, I'm sorry, 2 times in document 4, whereas contaminated appears blah, 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 then complicated appears in fewer documents than contaminated. Should have picked two easier words than each part. Complicated appears in more documents than interesting. Yes? Okay? So your intuition, I want a nice specific term, has a mathematical interpretation. I want a term that doesn't appear in a lot of documents. It's the same thing. Nothing changed, right? I just found a way to say it. Now I can actually go count this. So, what's the most specific term here?
Interesting.
Interesting, because it appears in only one document.
Siberia.
Siberia appears in only one document. Which one's more specific? Interesting or Siberia?
Interesting.
Neither. They both appear in one document. Oh. This is an important point. The question was, which will result in a more specific search? What do we mean by more specific? It will find fewer documents. How many does interesting find? One. How many does Siberia find? One. No matter how many times Siberia appears in that document, it's just as specific as any other term that only appears in one document. So just on specificity, that's not to say it's not good that it appears twice, right? But it's good for some other reason. If I'm talking about specificity, the measure of specificity is the number of documents something appears in. And we give that a very confusing name. We call it the document frequency. Okay? Number of documents something appears in, we call it the document frequency. Now, it's a confusing name because the number of times the term appears in the document, we call the term frequency. They're different. They're very different. We use similar words for them in English, and I'm sorry about that. And I actually, in an earlier version of the slide, tried to come up with completely different terms so it could really be confusing. But these are the terms everybody else uses. So just to have the idea, the term frequency is a fact about a term, like complicated, in a document like document 3. And that number is 5. Alright? So the term complicated has a term frequency of 5 in document 3, and it has a term frequency of 2 in document 4. And so the term frequency is a fact about a term in a document. It's not about a fact about a term. It's not a fact about a document. It's a fact about a term in a document. So the term frequency is about what we call the cell in the table, or what we call the entry element in the matrix. All right? Okay, so term frequency is that. And that's actually not too confusing until I tell you that the document frequency is how many documents fall out of here again. And you're like, now we're using similar words to mean different things. Right? Because the document frequency is 3. And just to be really confusing, the document frequency is not a fact about a document. It's a fact about a term. It's not a fact about a term in a document. It is a fact about a term. Yes? So it's just a confusing name. And I'm really sorry the name is confusing. Just remember what it means. The document frequency is unchanged if I change all these to binary. The term frequency changed. Okay. Now, if you have a sense for symmetry, you should feel unsatisfied. We got a fact about a term, which we call the document frequency. We got a fact about a term in a document, which we call the term frequency. There really should be some fact about a document, right? I mean, the document's getting short shrift here. So we have a fact about a document, and that fact is the number of terms that appear in the document. Right? So term frequency is the element, or the cell. Document frequency is computed from the row, so we'll compute something from the column. So the fact about the document is 4 plus 5 plus 6 plus 3 plus 2. That would be 9, 15, 18, 20. And what will we call that? The length. The number of terms in the document, right? Yes? Here is the key idea from tonight. There are only 3 things we know about as evidence for retrieval. We know about term frequency, document frequency, and length. And everything we do is going to be a function of those 3 observable things. If we can make that table, we can compute those numbers. And if we can compute those numbers, we just have to find a way to combine those numbers to get a score. All of information retrieval, content-based, is based on those 3 numbers. Okay? All right. Now, I really tell when you connect, right? The people are still great. Mm-hmm. Actually, one of the reasons I like being in the room, because there's audible feedback. And you could probably not actually have the thing turned on if you do that sort of clause, right? All right, now, if I have a query, that tells me which terms to pay attention to. The query is always going to have, for the simple life we're living tonight, 1 instance of every term. Right? So it's a vector that's 1 this way, 1 that way, 1 that way, you know, so on and so forth. Okay? For as many terms as you wish to put in it. So we can think of it as having 3 terms, for example, just so we can visualize. That tells us which terms to focus on. Now, let me pick up a document. I've got my query, it's got my 3 terms in it. I pick up a document, and that document might have some term frequency for one of these query terms or some other term frequency. Do I want that term frequency to be higher or lower? Is term frequency a good thing? Do I want more of it? Yes, right? If terms tell me what the document's about, then if I give you a query term fish, I want to have like fish, 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 fish. This document's about fish.
No, McDonald's, right? McDonald's, McDonald's, McDonald's. Right? I want the term fixed. Higher is good. Lower is bad. Right? Zero would be really bad. I don't have any words in my query. How about document frequency? Do you want document frequency to be higher or lower? On what?
Well, it might depend on what you already know about that document or about that information you're seeking.
Excellent.
It might just depend on one document.
Yes. So all other things being equal, if the term frequency is the same, for example, between two terms in two different documents, would I prefer higher document frequency or lower document frequency?
Higher.
Higher, lower. Like I said, you guys don't agree very often. Why?
Well, document frequency is how many times or how many documents a term falls in. You want a lower document frequency because, again, the term is more discriminating. It falls in fewer documents. It's going to find you a bunch more discrete set.
So I like Siberia, which has a document frequency of 1. More than I like information, which is in every document, as a document frequency of 1. It's just the way we have in the county, right? We define document frequency to increase when the term is becoming more common. So because we defined it that way, and we want less common terms, then we want low document frequencies and high term frequencies. Yes?
I guess I was looking at low document frequencies, maybe a flaw of the algorithm, not pulling all the documents thoroughly.
Oh, so this is the whole collection. Just imagine that's the whole collection. So now
I don't understand why necessarily that a document, that a term is in fewer documents, means that's relevant than the other term.
Okay, so normally if you're going to construct a query, you're going to have an idea of which concepts are important and which concepts are not so important, which concepts are good search terms, which ones are not so good search terms. You'll try to use the important concepts and the good search terms for that, right? Now, so just imagine that you're a clueless web searcher for a moment. You don't know any of these things. You just type in a bunch of words. Then I'd like the machine to figure out which of your words is more important, which ones are more common, and do the best it can for you. So I'm going to try to take your query term, and I'm going to try to, you know, sometimes you see these tag fields where some of the terms are written real big and some of them are written real small.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to blow up the important ones. And my measure of importance is it doesn't appear in very many documents, so it's a really selective term. Now, it's not a perfect approach, but it's a better approach than the opposite to say, oh, let's blow up the ones that appear in lots of documents. Right? What's that?
If you
use then we'd be searching for all the documents with blood. If that's for Smokey the Bear, I find everything with blood.
Right.
With me?
I'm with you, but if you want both terms,
yeah.
Like if I search for Siberia, which presumably is not very common, and cat, which is probably very common. What I want is everything with Siberia and cat, and something that has Siberia in it without cat is no more relevant than something that has cat in it without Siberia.
You need a Boolean search engine, my friend. You've thought through your problem really well. But your friend next door might ask about Siberian cats because they're interested in Siberian things like cats, or because they're interested in all kinds of cats, including Siberian cats, and they've already asked about the rest of the cats. Or we don't know why you asked about Siberian cats. I mean, you know, we're just running this web search engine, right? So you give us a bunch of words, and I've got two choices. I can either find you all the cats and give you extra points for Siberian, or I can find you all the Siberian things and give you extra points for cats. I mean, I don't have much. I got a pretty dumb search engine here. Okay, so now I want to know which of those to do. Now, it's an experimental question whether this is a good idea. But it's not an experimental question that this is the idea. So these things are actually built this way. And then we can actually tweak it and find out whether it's right. And it turns out it's pretty close, but it's not right. Okay? And I'll show you where the error is. Done. Okay. Now, you got the basic idea. I want to give myself, any query that has complicated and fallout in it, I want to give more weight to complicated because it's a more specific term and less weight to boring. That's what I want to do. So I want a document that has, I'm sorry, I want to give more weight to terms that have low document frequencies. Yeah.
So,
here's how we do it. High term frequency is evidence of meaning, low document frequency is evidence of importance. And so, because I have trouble thinking about, I want this one high and this one low, I'm just going to take the one that I want low and I'm going to flip it over and make it high. So I just take 1 over the document frequency, and now I want that to be high. You could have done that lots of other ways, but that's the way we did it. Right? Good thing we want minus or any number of things. Okay, so why do we call that the inverse document frequency? Okay, an inverse document frequency is a measure of specificity that when it's high is good. So now I've got everything that when it's high is good. Now, I want the term frequency to be high, and I want the document frequency to be high. Oh, my greedy. Right? So what do? Well, I can, like, add them together. That way, when they're both high, I get a high score, and when they're both low, I get a low score. Or I could multiply them together. That way, when they're both high, I get a really high score. And when they're both low, when either one's low, I get a really low score. Right? So multiplying turns out to work better, so I'm going to multiply it. So I'm just going to take the term frequency, and I'm going to multiply it by the document frequency.
The inverse document frequency.
Okay? Now, here's the formula. So let n be the total number of documents, so we're just getting our notation straight. Let df be the documents that contain term I, whatever I term you're interested in. And let the term frequency of ij be the number of times term I appears in document j. Then, the weight for term I in document j is the term frequency times, oops, there's the logarithm, of n over the df. All right, so if n is 4 and df is 2, this is 2 over 4 flipped. Right? That flip bit is what makes it inverse. So you don't have to do the math now, you get to do that for homework. So here's the math. So I've got complicated. It appears in 2 documents out of how many? 4. So I take 2 over 4, that's 25. I flip it. 2, logarithm of 2.
Well, it depends on what base we're going to do logarithm 2.
Anyway, pick a base, you get 0.31. Okay, that's a lot of base samples. Okay, so I just hit the logarithm button in my calculator. The computers all have calculators built into them. It's got a scientific mode, it's got a logarithm button. So I do that, and this is a number that behaves just the way you want. So here's a word that appears in every document. So I take 4 over 4, 1. Flip it, I get 1. Logarithm of that is 0, because anything to 0 power is 1. It's, I mean, sorry, that's true. But you can find it out, right? You put the logarithm button with 1 in there, and you get a 0. So I get a 0. Okay, so I get no credit if I'm in every document. So this is my IDF column. If I'm in all but one document, I get a quarter credit. I get more credit if I'm in all but 2. I get lots of credit if I'm in all but 3. This kind of behaves the way you want, right? I'm getting, but it behaves like this, that if I got a billion documents, I get no credit for being in all 1 billion of them. And if I got a billion minus 1, I still get no credit. Billion minus 2, I still get no credit. But if I'm on only one document, I get a lot of credit. Right? So that's why the logarithm is kind of nice, because I don't want to go taking away equal amounts of credit. Sorry, proportion.
You mean the logarithm is just a technique for probabilities?
Yeah, here's that comes from information theory.
Okay. I mean, right.
There's another class. Right. I mean, look, so you can equally well use the square root.
it behaves the same way, right? It's got a kind of similar shape to it, and you could ask experimentally, do I like square roots better than logarithms? Logarithms work better.
Okay.
And then you can say, oh, and there are lots of logarithms in information theory, and then people write papers about, well, information theory explanation doesn't really work here, but the logarithm really works really well. So it's what people do. But you want something that looks like that,
right?
And logarithm happens to look like that, and it's sort of cognitive economy. We learn a whole lot of different functions. Right? We need a function that looks like that, here's a logarithm. Okay? Okay, so that's where the idea comes from. Now, that's the term frequency, and that's the IDF, right? So, here, let's take an easy one. That's the term frequency, 1. Here's the IDF, 0.125. So, what do you think should go here? Term frequency times the IDF, right? Okay, 0.125, which I wrote 0.13 just because it's one of the fairly small papers. Okay? You can do that for all of them. 3 times 0, anybody do that one for me? 0. Okay. So you get the idea, right? Okay, so you can do this at home. All right, so that gets me this. Now, it turns out that doesn't work. Here's why. So let's say I took contaminated and retrieval as my query. Then I would put document 2 here. I have a document 2 here. To see that, we just take contaminated here and retrieval, and we take 0.75 plus 0.13, add them up. That's going to be the score for document 2. Notice I didn't take the whole column, I just took the ones that were in my query. And then, for document 3, I take 0.38 and 0.13, add them up. It'll be pretty obvious that the first one was better than the second one, right? And you can do that for all. So I'm going to get this order. You see that I can do that computation, right? You just get scores for all 4 of them, just from those 2 rows, and then sort them, right? So I'm just taking this row and this row, adding them up, and doing the sort. Problem is, some of these documents have more words in them than others. So for example, document 2 is a pretty parsimonious document. It doesn't have a lot of words in it. And document 1 has got a lot of words in it. So I'm giving document 1 the same credit for having a word in it that document 2 is getting. Now, is that fair?
No, because the longer a document is, the more chance the probability is higher that another word is consistent with the end.
Right. So, for example, I could take a short document. I could just append it to itself several times, and you tell me, oh, that's a better document. I'm like, you're on grids, man. Why would I want that document? All right? That's no better than the whole thing was.
I didn't have a question.
Okay. So, we want to normalize for the length. Yep. Now, you remember when I told you about the celestial sphere and how my arrows were really long, but I pulled them back to the celestial sphere? That's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to go and take the really long arrow and pull it back to the celestial sphere. So what do? We calculate the length of the arrow, and we divide by it. And then the length will be 1. Yes? Okay. So that's the geometric interpretation. So we're computing scores over the whole document, so people are really looking for things that have useful parts. And so because the document lengths vary, we can either adjust the term frequencies to account for the document length, or we can split the document up into equal length parts, in which case we won't have the problem anymore. Here's the first of the 2 strategies, which is the more commonly used one. So long documents are getting unfair advantage, as we talked about. We're going to use this technique called document length normalization to sort it out. Here's the equation. For every weight, we add up all of the weights in that document. So remember, this is term I in document J, so we add up what's that?
Yeah,
it should have been over the eyes. We add up the length of the numbers, or the length, we add up the weights, we divide it by the, we square it, divide it by the square root, and that is, let me do this visually, 1, 2, 3 over 1. So it's at least 3 long, but it's a little longer than 3. And it turns out that it's the 3 squared plus 1 squared, square root of that, that's the length of this. It's the Pythagorean theorem, right? The c squared, right? The square of the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the square of the other two sides, right? In geometry, but we're doing this in 100,000 dimensions, so we just do that over and over again. So this is just that equation. And so that gives us this. So I got my document 1 here. I go across all the terms of the document. That's what I should have done. 0.5 squared, that's 0.25. 0.63 squared, that's 0.38, something like that. 0.9 squared, that's 0.81. 1.2 squared, that's what I know, 2.44. Add them all up and take the square root. It turns out to be 1.7 because I have my calculator. Okay? So I couldn't do that in my head, but you get the idea. So I take all of these, and then I just take this number, I take this divided by that, and get this. This divided by that, and get this. This divided by that, and get this, so on and so forth. Got it? Now, instead of doing the computation on the rows of this, they do the computation on the rows of this, and it's exactly what I described to you earlier. We're up on the celestial sphere. Okay? Everything's projected to you in length.
Did you say we're going to do this for our own work?
I don't know. I'll check on the right. Do you want to ask more questions if that's the case?
Well, I understand the math, but I'm having a hard time plotting that in the matrices.
Okay. Let's check on the break and we'll go through what the homework is.
Okay.
So, if you really like mathematics, so the rest of you can sign out, but you're okay on the math, so let's go. The similarity of document J and document K is the inner product of the vectors representing document J and document K divided by the product of their length. Okay? Which is this when written out with all them sigmas. This is the same as that. This is shorthand. This is longhand. Right? And
this piece parallel bars mean the length of?
The length of. The absolute value is the length of.
Yeah.
In one dimension, the absolute value is the length. Right? So you take a point this way or a point that way, so the absolute value is the length. So the length generalizes to 100,000 dimensions. It really does. Right? Which it's simply this, right? This is that. Okay? And so this is the document part and this is the query part. With me? If you want to be with me, are you with me?
We're multiplying the length.
What's that?
The length of case where there's side by side, they're multiplying, right?
Yeah, that's being multiplied. Okay? So this is just a way of writing it, but we don't actually do this because the query part, this part here, is being done repeatedly for everything. So it doesn't change the rank order. So we don't have to bother with this. We'll just skip that. This part is being folded into this. So these weights, this thing is what we index. We index this over this. Because all the things in this are knowable and indexing time. So we index this over this. This part we ignore, because it doesn't change the ranking. And this part is the query. And it simply says, for every term in the query, do this. Which is selector. So the graphical version I showed you, which by now probably didn't make any sense, you know, the tables, is the same as the equation that I just showed you, which probably doesn't make any sense. Okay?
Is this being implemented?
Yes. Yeah, this is real.
So
those tables, are those actually stored?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So what we index, what we index is this. This is the postings file. The postings file says document 3, this weight, document 4, this weight.
For every term.
For every term. For term, for term 1, 3.57, 4.69. For term 2, 1.29, 2. 103, 3, 104. For term 4, nothing. For term 5, 2.62. That's the postings.
This is updated every week, as you said, in the last lecture at school.
No, but the computers don't get bored. You just program them once a
week. Does this take care of the fact that if I search for retrieval contaminated in the opposite order?
You'll get exactly the same response. The system will give you the same response. It doesn't know about order or proximity. So we just haven't told. We could add those to the, you know, add a few more terms to your equation, and add more information to your index, and you could do that.
That is done at least.
It's done in reality, yes. Okay? Other questions? Does it make sense what we've done? Not necessarily all the details of how to do it, but enough of the details that you could go home and work back through the details with the slides in front of you? Okay? That's the goal. Okay. Now, this part, you can zone out, again, if you are not mathematically inclined. But the kind of length normalization that we did is called cosine length normalization. So people say, I use the cosine measure. And what they mean is, that's the term frequency, I multiply the inverse acting frequency, I use the logarithm, just like I told you. Then I did my length normalization by projecting down to the unit sphere. That's what they mean. Now, why would you call it cosine normalization? Well, it turns out, if this is the query vector, and this is the document vector, then the number you compute is the cosine, you remember from trigonometry, of that angle, which is the angle between the two vectors. So, here you get the snapping fish analogy. If I have a query over here and a document over there, they are really far away apart, right? On the celestial sphere, they're a very long way apart. How do I measure distance on the celestial sphere? By how far it is along the sphere. That's the measurement of that is called the angle. I mean, we think of the angle as this, but it's actually the distance on the celestial sphere, along the sphere. That's the angle, right? We measure it in degrees. 360 is all the way around, what fraction of 360? Okay, so this, long way apart. Okay, this, very close. Okay, so if I have, what I want is I want a number that is big when things are really close together, and small when things are really far apart, right? But it turns out that the angle behaves oppositely from that. The angle is big when they're far apart, right? But I want a big number the other way, right? It turns out if you take the cosine of the angle, it works brilliantly. The mathematical function of cosine. And it turns out the mathematical function of the cosine is computed by that formula. Right? So, which is this formula down here. So the cosine of the angle is computed this way. Okay. So that's why it gets called cosine. So here's how it works. You think about the query and the document as if they're vectors. Doesn't matter if you treat the query as something that needs to be normalized or not, because it just introduces a constant factor in all the scores. So if I get a score of 0.2 and a score of 0.4, if I double both of them, I'd have a score of 0.4 and a score of 0.8. It wouldn't make any difference to me. I'd still put them in the same order. So it doesn't really matter if you do query normalization. It doesn't change anything. You can skip the square root, too, because it doesn't change anything in the cosine formula. So it was missing from the actual formula I showed you. And then we just compute the similarity between the two vectors. So small angle is very similar, large angle is little similarity, and this is kind of what you want. Yeah?
Do this make sense for term? But I'm not sure I understand if you're a document or a query to be a single vector.
you're not sure how to turn a query or a document into a single vector.
Yeah, so you can compare a query to a document.
Good. So, I'm confused by the kind of make sense for terms. So let me try it again. What are they? Fish, birds, cats, and fish, right? Birds. Three birds. One cat. So that cat's eating birds.
This is what I tell that kid.
So that's a vector.
The terms are the direct.
Terms are directions.
Right.
And then
in the equation, I don't have things like, I don't see the directions represented in the equation.
You don't see the directions represented in the equation. Okay, good.
That on the table. Yeah.
That's an excellent question. We can
answer. On the table, the directions are represented by nice English words like complicated, concatenated, fallout.
Yes, yes. So here's a document. Right? And this document has zero in the complicated direction. So
yeah.
It's got 0.29. I'm sorry, 0.29 in the contaminated direction. It's got 0.37 in the fallout direction.
Okay. So this equation has to run for every term in the corpus?
Yeah, yeah. So this is very long. Okay. And very wide.
So that's why you said we have 100,000 vectors, right?
So that's why you have 100,000 dimensions.
That's fair enough. Yeah.
And a billion vectors if you have really talking about. Yes? Plus one more for the bird.
Okay.
It's okay? Done.
Yeah, that was the key thing that you're comparing to all the terms. Because that gives you the direction. Like the cat. It's complicated direction. Everything that is really in a query or document has a complicated direction. The measure direction might be
zero.
I mean zero, but it does have a complicated dimension to it.
Yes. Everything is complicated.
Yes. Four choices are worse.
Fortunately, everything is also simple.
Yeah. I'm falling out.
And everything is nuclear, which would make you worry. Yep. Okay. We're good? Okay. So that's not what we really did. But it's very close to what we did. I mean, we did that for years. The Lycos search engine actually did that. It turns out, using techniques that I will show you next week, you can tell how well that's doing. And then you can say to yourself, well, what if we didn't use the logarithm? What if we use the square root? Well, let's see how that does. What if we use the absolute value of the cube root? Well, then, I mean, we could just try everything we can think of, right? So this is for people who don't, this is for unprincipled scientists, right? People who don't really, they're not attached to a theory. You're just going to try all the formulas they can think of and see which one works best. Once you can measure how well your system does, you can do that. This is the main point for next week's class. Measurement is the fundamental factor in advancing engineering in the absence of science. If you have good science, you have nice theories, then you can build the right thing. But if you've got no theory, and you can measure things to see how well they're doing, you can try everything and see which one works. Right? So this is an evaluation-driven field, and the people who do careful evaluations, well motivated, they still keep the term frequency in the numerator and the document frequency in the denominator. Right? I mean, they know that much, right? They come up with better techniques. How much better techniques? About 40%. What does 40% mean? Ask me next week. Okay. Right? Because it's 40% of something, and I have to show you how that something is calculated. Right? Okay. So, here's the real formula. The weight of term I in document J is the term frequency of I in document J
times the logarithm of the number of terms. The number of documents in the collection divided by the document frequency of term share.
What about all the
data
underneath?
Oh, yeah. Well, all that data underneath is what makes it work. But the formula is the same as the one you saw. This is that times this. A little bunch of stuff around. Nothing much changed, right? People just went in and they sprinkled a few more things in. Okay. Now, you say, okay, how did they come up with this? Well, this part here is the main innovation. So what this says is, we're going to take the length of the document I, which is the number of terms in document I that I showed you how to compute earlier. You just add them up. No weights here. Count the terms, add them up. Okay? Do that for every document and find the average length. Take the length of document I divided by the average length. That's how much longer this document is than average. Okay? So that number could be twice as long as average. Half as long as average. Or average. Okay? Then, plug it into this formula. So this is the term frequency, the length, the average length, and nothing else, right? It's just a formula with all those things in it. Somebody had to make up the 1.5 and the 0.5 and figure out that the term frequency ought to be sitting here too, right? Once you get that, you can plot. So let's say you set L sub I over L to 1. You get this dark bar. So what does this dark bar say? Looks a lot like the logarithm thing over there, right? But I can draw a lot of things that look like this. This is the one for twice as long. This is the one for half as long. Okay? So what this says is, if the term frequency is 5, give me 75% of the credit, of the maximum possible credit. If the term frequency is 10, give me 82% of the maximum possible credit. If the term frequency is 20, give me 90%. And if it's more than 20, well, I don't want much more credit. Right? I mean, if it's a billion, give me all the credit. Right? So you got a graph that looks like that. So that just says, look, if I got a document and it's about fish, and it's fish, that's twice as good as just fish. Good. Get the length is the same. But if it's fish, well, it's not 100 times as good, right? It's maybe 4 times as good. So I want to do the same kind of trick, right? What do I want the formula to look like? Well, this turns out to be better than the logarithm. By a little bit if you can run experiments. Got it? Okay, so the original thing I showed you looked like this. We didn't even bother drawing it, it was just the term frequency. The term frequency, plot the same thing over here, it'll just be a straight line. So we got a graph that looks about like we like. And now, instead of having to do all that complicated cosine, you know, fishing net thing, now all we do is we just say, oh, look, let's see how much longer it is than average, and adjust your line a little bit using this formula. With me? Okay. Now what do we do over here? Well, it turns out if you really do know information theory, then you can re-derive from first principles of probability what should have been the document frequency. And if you do that, you get n over df, just like before, except you have to put a 0.5 factor on it. This comes literally, you have to put a bunch of points. The reason I put? Because look, here's what's happening. And this is really going to be important after the break. I get to observe the world. And everything in the world happens either 0 times, or 1 time, or 2 times, but nothing ever happens half a time. If it really is, if I observed it a million more times, really it would have happened half a time, I will have either observed 0 or 1. I mean, look, if I have, let's say that green-eyed people, if green-eyed people are very, very unusual. And only one person in 10 is green-eyed. And I've got 3 people here. How many of them do you think will be green-eyed? Maybe none, maybe one, probably not all 3, right? So I can only observe 0, 1, 2, or 3. Those are the only possibilities. I can't observe half a green-eyed person. I quit, but we have another problem. Okay? Got the idea? So I can't observe half a thing happening. But in fact, in statistics, half a thing does happen. Right? Something could be half as likely to happen as something else, and both be observed as zero. Or both be observed as one. So it turns out this trick works beautifully for covering for that. It says, if I don't observe it at all, think about it as a good. That's as good as it occurring half a time. I can't tell the difference between a zero and half. So just treat everything that's zero as a half, everything that's one is one and a half, everything that's two is two and a half. That trick is beautiful, and we'll see it again. Right. So you can play with these numbers, and you find out those are right. And then the thing you wouldn't have expected is this. If you make those adjustments, then as the document frequency goes up, the IDF goes down, just like you'd expect, and the formula I showed you before falls off like this, and this formula follows very closely. So it's a very small improvement. This is a big difference. This is a small difference. When you take this, you multiply it by that, you get the system for ranking documents based on their content that is used in the world today. That formula. Now, if you have proximity, if you have links, you do more stuff, so the web search engine do 40% better than this because they use other evidence. But for this evidence, that's it. Okay? Now, the other thing I have to tell you is these numbers, 1.5, 0.5, yeah, those two, those might be different in different collections. Might be different for different problems. Might be different for different languages. So you do have to go tune those.
So this is for English?
Yes. And English newspapers. Okay. Why don't we take a break here? And when we come back, we'll finish this very briefly. There's just one little trick left. And then we'll do probability. The other way. How long is the break? 5 minutes and 14 seconds. And I cut you short by 14 seconds on the last one. Either way.
but I'd like to check it for that. Okay.
So there was a question about the
the homework. So the homework has an unusual structure, the details of which I wasn't remembering, which I'm glad you got a look. So the homework is, for next week, is to answer the question, what are you going to do in your project? So send me answers to questions like, which project do you like, first, second, and third choices. Well, actually, first and second choices, because the first one's obvious, they're only three. What role do you want in your team, and what's your background, and things like that. So it's not really what you consider hard homework. It's not graded. You don't send this to me, I'll just randomly assign you a project team. Question?
Finish it,
then. Okay. And then the week after that, you get the homework from today's class. So this assumes that you went home from today's class, you go, what in the world did you do? And you come back next week, and you ask questions, and then you're ready to do the homework. Right? Okay? What's that? Was that the question?
No, but...
Okay, and you'll recognize it, right? Document 1 has got these words in it, Document 2 has got those words in it, so on and so forth. Make up a matrix, do the math, figure out the order, so on and so forth, right? You've seen all this stuff before. Okay, and actually, I just looked down far enough that I'm going to take out question 4 here. Okay, which is something I'm not teaching this
time
around. Okay, question.
Maybe this isn't the right time for the answer, but for the project, what are we building? Because we're not programming, right? So are we designing something and taking it just to that level, or are we building things out of publicly available
tech clay?
Yeah. So, let me take most of the answer to the end of class, right? Because I find that people get tired at the end of class, and these sorts of questions about what am I going to get graded for tend to energize people. So I like to use them at the end of class. But the short answer is that you will work in a team that will build it and test the system. But you won't build it from sticks, from ones and zeros. You'll build it from existing systems that you adapt to your purpose.
That you can download.
Yes, you could download them and spend half the rest of your life configuring. Okay. So we now return you to your regularly scheduled class. So ignore the thing over there. Everything I told you about document length normalization, you can skip. If you simply take documents and make them all the same. So if you just get the authors to always write documents of the same length, then you have a very easy length. Right? Now, an easy way to do that is just get the authors to write abstracts and then just index the abstracts. And so all that document length normalization stuff was not well understood until authors started writing things of different lengths. When the only thing we could afford to index was abstracts, we didn't see these problems. Okay? Now, we can get abstracts back out of documents by taking an automatic abstract writer and having it write an abstract, and then we can index it, and we'd be back where we started. So here's the simple way of doing that. If you write a long document, let's say I want a 300-word abstract in the document. I'll just take the first 300 words. Well, that might not be good. So I'll take the last 300 words. Well, that might not be good. I'll just take every possible 300 words. Well, that's probably enough. I'll take 300 words, I'll skip 150, I'll take another 300 words, I'll skip 150, I'll take another 300 words. You get the idea? So I have overlapping passages that are automatically formed. Now, these are going to start in kind of the wrong place, and they're going to end in kind of the wrong place, but some of them are going to be like beautifully lined up on a little topical segment of the document. And then what I'll do is I'll treat them as if they're documents, and I'll index them. And I'll rank them. And instead of ranking documents, now I'm ranking passages. Not perfectly formed passages, but okay formed passages. So now I'm ranking these passages. I've got my passage ranking system. And then for a document to give it a rank, I find the score of the best scoring passage in the document, and I say, that's the score of the document. And now every document has a score, and I score it, and I rank. Sound simple? And I don't have to worry about document length normalization because they're all the same. Okay. This actually works. It works really well
And when you do it, I mean, it's more work because you have to get all this proliferation tests, right? But when you do this, you then get this extra thing that when I find the document, it doesn't just say, well, here's your document. Your query retrieved the Holy Bible. Here's the Holy Bible. Good luck. The answer is somewhere in there. Right? Instead, what it says is, here's the document that has your answer right here. Which is kind of nice, right? Okay, so this passage ranking trick, which avoids document length normalization, also allows you to help focus the user's examination behavior. Okay? All right.
What do you do with the remainder?
Oh, I don't know. What I would do is I would just, when I got to the bottom, I'd stop, and I'd take 300 words back from that. So I just have a little bit different overlap there.
Okay.
But it's such a rough technique anyway. By the way, the 300 is tuning experimentally. I run an experiment, I see how 300 is, I got 299, 301, 300 works best, I pick up. Okay. And that's produced very soon. My work is for reducing that. Alright, so what's the summary? Well, we're going to find all documents that are most similar to the query. We're going to compute, normalize term weights. So somehow we account for this document length effect. Some combination of TF, DF, and length. We sum up the weights for every query term, which is linear algebra, as I showed you in the inner product operation. And we're done. That gives us a score for everything. We sort them. And that's the optimal rank order. And then we have a question, how good is that rank order? And so come to class next week, you find out what that rank order is, then you go back and try some variant of this. And you see which one you like best. Now, if you are a young Turk, you're a red hot new grad or a new PhD student in information retrieval, and you want to make your mark, what do? You tune this just a little bit better? Nah, that won't catch a fails. You come up with some completely new way of doing it? Nah, nobody would buy into your way of thinking. Right? So what you do is the second, but you have to do it in a way the world is ready for. So all the pieces have to come together. Somebody has to develop all the mechanism in some other field. And then you come along and you swipe some good ideas out of some other field and drop them down in the middle of this field. And you say, hey, look, these people over here have legitimized this kind of research. And here's how it applies to the problem we're trying to solve. Right? So it turns out the people who legitimized this kind of research were people who were trying to do speech recognition. And they wanted to know how to tell whether I just said how to recognize speech or how to wreck a nice speech. That was the question. And the way that you tell whether I said ice cream or I scream is you look at what do people tend to say. And if people don't say how to recognize speech very often, and they say how to recognize speech a lot, then you guess the more common of the two hypotheses, even though they're both supported by the sounds I make. Right? Your ear hears it, unless I really make it hard for you, and it's how to wreck a nice beach, right? Your ear wants to hear from the setup, from the priming I gave you. I told you working on speech recognition. You hear how to recognize speech. Yes? But it's the same sounds I'm producing. Okay, so that technique is called language modeling. And what I do is I compute the probability of every sentence in the language. I come up with some technique for computing that probability, and then when my recognizer guesses 50 possibilities, I just pick the one that's most likely. So to be able to come up with a statistical model of which sentences are most likely to have been uttered was the fundamental technique that the folks in speech recognition had to solve after they solved the earlier part of figuring out how to get from the sounds to which words those might have been. So that's the acoustic model and the language model. And in fact, you'll be happy to hear that they don't know anything we don't know. They take the acoustic model score and they multiply it by the language model score, and that's the best they can do. Looks a whole lot like TFI. Right? So, these young jerks came along, all three in the same year, and said, hey, we could do this this way. And they all wrote up slightly different variants of it. Now, you want to understand the way that they reformulated the question, you have to think about what did you mean when you said you were going to model relevance as similarity. What you meant, if you stop and think about it, is that you're going to say, if something is more similar, then it's more relevant. Right? So like relevance has degrees to it. Some things are more relevant than others. You probably actually believe this, right?
You could ask me for something, I could give you a couple things and say, that one's better than that one.
Yes? That's what you were doing. You were thinking of relevance as if it were graded in some sense. You were trying to grade the scores by the degree of relevance. Right? So if I ask you, is it relevant? You say, somewhat. How much? Well, you put a score on it. We'll sort it by that. That's not the question we're going to do now. The question we're going to do now is, you say, is it relevant? And I say, probably. And you say, well, what's the probability that it is relevant? Oh, what's the probability that it isn't? They must add up to one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, if you think about that, that's a big change. I mean, in this world, everything is relevant or not. No halfway. It's either relevant or it's not, and we don't know which. But we do know the probability that it's relevant. It's a binary random variable in the geek speak. Right? It's binary, we just don't know what it is. That's what it means by random. It's not known. Right? It doesn't mean it's completely unknown, we just don't know everything about it. Right? So we can characterize it. It's more likely that it isn't. But it's either one or zero. Now, look, we know that's not true. But we knew that similarity wasn't relevant either. We were still happy to try it. So that's what we're going to do here. We're going to say, if we can rank order things by their probability of being relevant, would that be useful? And the answer is, yes. Another question is, how useful is it? And the answer is, actually, just as useful as writing it by similarity. But it's a more informative story. The assumptions we have to make to do this, they tell us something about what we've done. Like, somebody asked about all these terms being unrelated to each other. Go this way, go this way, and these things are orthogonal, in particular. Unrelated, they're each equal contribution. We'll formalize that to the notion of statistical independence. So we'll begin to give more formal interpretations to things that were lying there in the vector space, but we didn't have good ways of talking about them. Okay, and then we'll apply it to rank. So you'll be happy to hear, because of time, that I'll stop after this one. Because you all have given me this great look. And so we'll pick up here next time, start with this, and then do the evaluation. If we don't finish the evaluation, we'll just continue. Okay? We'll continue to roll. All right, so here's the basic idea. This will blow your mind. Do you ever wonder where queries come from? What's that?
Users.
So how does the user produce them? What do they do?
Think.
This could be hard. No, I have a much simpler model. I know where queries come from. Now, I'm wrong, but at least I know.
The glaciers, you
mean? Oh, that's all very funny. That's
even
yeah. Okay, so here's where queries come from. The user who wants a document on some subject, they imagine the document, right? They call forth in their mind the document, and the document has a bunch of words in it, and they select some words from the document they imagine, and some other words from the language, just to spice things up a little bit. Some words that might have been in the document, but aren't. Right? So that's it. This is where queries come from. They come from imagining a document, selecting with uniform probability, the words that are in the document, so I can take the first word and the second word without regard to what they are. The 15th word, the 27th word. The most common ones that get picked more often because I'll run across them more often, right? So I just pick words out of the document. Every once in a while, I just get a brilliant idea and pick a word out of a dictionary. not on the house. So I got a dictionary over here, I got the document over there, I just pick a bunch of words out of the document, a few words out of the dictionary, present them to you as a query. And then the question I come back and ask you, since I know now where the query came from, is which documents did you have in mind? So I just rank all the documents by the likelihood that that's the document you had in mind. Right? So I build a language model for every document, and then I observe the language model of the query, and I ask the question, to what extent do they diverge? If they're the same, well, that was the document you had in mind. If they're very different, probably not the document you had in mind. You see what we're doing? So, if we formalize that, we have an alternate way of ranking documents. Okay. Now, what I wanted to do, and so that's what the cartoon test was, which we'll do more with. Yeah, next time. So, there have been a few questions about the project, and there are two things that are important to know about the project. With any luck, that'll work. Okay, so here's the deal. For the project, you can either form a team on your own, or you can have me form a team for you. If you want to have me form the team, you fill out a questionnaire. If you want to do a project on your own, you come see me by Thursday. Not with the answer, but with the question, with your beginning of a conversation. We have to get to the end of the conversation by the date on which the the project plan is due, which is October 30th. So next week's homework is not due next week. On Monday, due on Thursday. Actually, Wednesday, right? October 3rd, Wednesday?
Yes.
Sorry, Wednesday of next week. That means you can come to class and see the description of the third project, and then tell me which one you like. Because you'll see the second one tonight and the third one tomorrow. Or the third one next week. If you're going to do your own project, you owe me a plan that day for what you're going to do in your project. What's that? October 3rd. Okay? That doesn't have to be completely worked out, but it has to be. All right. So let me show you project two. So project one, you remember from last week, is index the State Department tables and make it a search system. And you saw they have a search system at the National Archives. And so make a better one. Except that lots of you actually like that one, so I don't know if you can't make a better one. Don't make that much. The second one is we have all these transcripts from the Apollo moon landing missions. So help the students figure out what these transcripts say. And the third one, let me see if I can make this picture better. I don't know if it will. The third one is the people in Dallas tried to make a system that none of you liked. So make a better system than the people in Dallas. Let's see. So, let me see. So these guys are talking on the moon, and at 15:58 the candles will say, "Al, this is Houston, if you would give us some commentary on how the legs go into the surface, because there are some legs and they're going into the surface." With any luck?
Al, this is Houston. If you would give us a commentary on how the legs go into the surface.
You get the idea, right? Okay. So maybe we want to know who Al is or who the canvas is or
the legs are in the surface of
what the hell are the legs of? Okay. So you get the idea about that, right? So you'll see here, this is an annotated transcript, and it said, Ed goes to the mesa, whatever the hell Ed is, whatever the hell mesa is, hopping sideways, we can probably guess what that means, and you might even see him hopping sideways on the picture, as he moves over from near the ladder, either what, during DJ missions. Oh, come on, this is really huge DJ. What the hell is DJ missions? Many of the astronauts, okay, of course, those are, you get the idea, right? This is like completely incomprehensible. And so, one of the things you can do is, they wrote like tons of stuff about this, right? There are press kits, there's debriefings, there's oral history interviews. And so, if kids in school want to use this stuff, you want to click on J missions and have it take you to something on J missions. Click on legs and all that, I know. You get the idea, right? You can just take the words. Like, you know, this thing. Well, if it came from the flight director, what the hell's a flight director? Okay, well, we'll just take flight director and we'll search for flight director and we'll find some stuff and we'll automatically link to them. All right, we got all the stuff out there. We got this information retrieval technology. We got a bunch of kids that want to understand this stuff, or maybe they don't, but they got to do it anyway. And so we're going to build them a automatic definition tool. Think of this as like building Wikipedia. Right, all those links in Wikipedia to definitions of things. Okay, so that's the setup. Right, so it says, build a system to help high school students make sense of the transcripts by helping to find references, you know, to explain events and technical terms they want to learn more about. You don't have to take it directly out of the transcripts, although you could. You can start with this code, which is available to you. So you've got that transcript viewer already, you've got the thing in HTML. It's already indexed, so if you want to know, or let's see, what word do you want to know if they said on the moon?
Funky.
Did they say funky on the moon? So let's see. Search results. They didn't say funky at all.
Sandwich?
I know sandwich.
How about
fun? Fun! I must have said that. Actually, I think this may be the one that has the broken search interface. Let's see. No, nothing was fun. Hold on a second. Oh, look at that, all those Java errors. Okay. The Java wasn't having errors, you could have searched. So I have a really nice one where you can see if it said chip. Which they did, but not on the radio. But there were recordings running onboard the spacecraft, and they got caught in media time. This is really good shit. She said that. Okay. So anyway, modulo the errors here. Search is already integrated into this, so it's got a really strong starting point for doing the search. Of course, it's only searching the transcripts now, but you can give it to search. Questions on this? So, who was it that said, what are we really doing on the project?
I think it was me.
Remind me.
Jason.
That's what I was going to guess, but, you know, I wanted to answer. So, what do you actually build? Well, here it is. It runs, right? So you can take this and you can index, for example, all the oral histories, which aren't indexed here, but actually have them indexed in another program. So they're all, I've got the text of all of them, they're just documents, just drop them into an information retrieval system. It does all the stuff we've talked about so far. You type in your queries, it builds rank lists, log in. So you could take any term and you could find the use of that term in oral histories. Then you could build this so that it takes it out of the transcript by highlighting the term and hitting search, and it would just force it into the query window and go search. So that's an example. But that's not what you should build. That's what you could build. What you should build is what you think you would want to build for high school students to do this. So how would you know that? Well, you'd probably go over to the education school and you meet with a couple of teachers and you ask them, you know, what would happen in their classrooms with this thing, and they tell you that it had to be usable within 10 minutes and couldn't take them more than an hour of preparation the night before, and, you know, had to have a teacher's guide, and, you know, you start to think about the problem differently after you talk to a few people who know about it. Then you go talk to a few high school kids and you find out that that's completely nonsense, you know. It had to be fun, and they had to be able to use it at home, and it had to be on the web, it had to look like a video game, right? And so, you know, after a while, you know what it is you wanted to do, and then you'd build it. And then you'd actually get a teacher and you put them in front of it, get a high school student, put them in front of it, don't let them at the same time. You'd see how well it worked, and you'd find out whether or not you built something good. But in the meantime, you would have gotten the evaluation stuff from next week to see how good your search was, and you would have looked at it a few times and said, well, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, right? Can you tune it up a little bit? So you got all kinds of parameters, like could you put in quotes around things and make that better, or a little proximity operator, or, you know, stuff like that. With me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you don't have to say, oh, let's see, 0011001, that's an A! There's already a program that does that. But you do have to say, you do have to say, what is it we're trying to do in the first place? And then figure out how to do it. Okay. Thank you very much, and if you want to stay late, Alistair will tell us about squaring the circle and
I have a question about doing your own project by this Thursday.
By this Thursday, if you want to do your own project, you have to contact me and talk to me about the project you want to do.
Technology plan.
That's why we have to talk.
Right?
You don't have to have that by this Thursday. The only thing you have to have by this Thursday is an idea that you don't like these three persons. Or that you don't like working in groups. Or that you haven't met anybody in the class that you want to work with. Okay? I just don't want you to get to the point where you're filling out the questionnaire and you're saying, gee, I don't like any of these. And it's like, okay, so please do a project plan by midnight. And have it be good. Oh, wait. So, last point to remember, there's an entire week out there. You're going to spend the week learning. The class is for structuring your learning. Right. So, interact with me, with each other, on the mailing list, spend time thinking about these things. Don't do this once a week. Get excited.
Problem might be.